Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. A recent decision by a committee of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade could open the way for dolphin-unsafe tuna. Environmentalists hope not. In fact, says David Phillips of Earth Island Institute, we've moved beyond such regressive politics.
These are not the priorities of the countries in the 90s, and GATT has to get with it and come to sensibilities about the role of free trade versus the environment.
Also this time, the end of Thomas Edison and the light of a new day, compact fluorescent bulbs. We hope you'll stay tuned. Some of the stories coming your way next on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. On appeal from Mexico, a special panel of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade has ruled that the United States may not enforce a ban importing tuna caught by Mexican fishermen. First, some background. Concerned that fishermen were netting and killing thousands of dolphin in the process of fishing on tuna in the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, the San Francisco-based Earth Island Institute last summer won an injunction from a U.S. district court that ordered the U.S. Commerce Department to, in turn, enforce a congressional ban on the import of tuna from several Pacific Rim nations, including Mexico. In February of this year, Mexico appealed the ban to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, claiming a restraint on free trade. Earth Island Executive Director David Phillips fears the panel's recommendation sets an offensive precedent.
This panel ruling makes it quite clear that the free trade types at GATT are intent on eviscerating international environmental laws, getting rid of all the national laws to protect dolphins, stop drift netting, stop trade in endangered species, elephant ivory, etc. It's potentially a very devastating attack on international environmental protection.
Well, what are the extended implications of this particular ruling? In other words, this—you've just alluded—this could be something of a precedent. Then you're saying?
Yes, this is the first time the GATT panel, which is an international panel set up to try to judge and reduce barriers to free trade, it's the first time that they have issued a ruling pertaining to the environment. And this ruling states that a country cannot limit trade in order to protect a resource that's outside of its own territorial area. We find this to be a very short-sighted and narrow view that flies completely in the face of the growing consensus of the need to take extraordinary actions at this point for the global environment. Taken to its conclusion, this would mean that no country could ban trade in ivory products in order to protect elephants if they didn't have elephants in their territorial area. No country could ban the import of drift net products. No country could limit trade in toxic wastes or trade in the parts of endangered species. That free trade would be given full precedence over the environment.
The ban stems from the Marine Mammal Protection Act, passed by Congress in 1972, the act is thought to be the strongest in the world, protecting not only dolphins, but seals, whales, and other marine mammals. The law prohibiting commercial whaling in the United States also bans the importing of any marine mammal product. A 1984 amendment specifically includes a ban on tuna from those nations using fishing techniques that also kill dolphin in higher numbers than allowed for the U.S. fleet. Though another amendment in 1988 allows up to 20,500 dolphins to be killed by the U.S. fleet, environmentalists estimate that up to 100,000 are being slaughtered by foreign fishing, especially from Mexico, Panama, Venezuela, Ecuador, and the island nation of Vanuatu, the nations targeted for the ban by Earth Island. Though somewhat daunted by the GATT panel ruling, Phillips is tentatively confident.
Mexico is the largest dolphin-killing country in the world, and we don't believe, and Congress didn't believe, that they should have access to U.S. markets in a way that's unfair to countries and our own industry that have adopted dolphin-safe fishing techniques. The courts ruled in our favor that the embargoes were legal, and in fact, this GATT panel ruling does not affect the embargoes in any way until such time as the Congress might choose to amend the laws to make them consistent with this ruling. Our view is that Congress shouldn't be bullied into throwing out dolphin protection laws or any other laws just to meet GATT's views. The protection of the international environment is something that the public feels very strongly about. And GATT has declared war on dolphins. GATT has declared war on the environment, but that doesn't mean that Congress has to succumb to the whims of this free trade bunch.
Starkist Seafood Company, an affiliate of the H.J. Heinz Company, based in Long Beach, California, took the lead with an April 12, 1990 announcement, which said, in part, "We pledge to you that nothing less than dolphin-safe tuna is acceptable." To achieve this, Starkist stated it would not buy any tuna caught together with dolphins in the eastern tropical Pacific. Though there was some controversy concerning the validity of similar statements from the other major distributors of canned tuna, in the end, as Michael McGowan, corporate vice president for Bumblebee Tuna, explains, the decisions were made not in the boardroom, but in the kitchens of American consumers.
As a company, Bumblebee, we have spent some time since we've purchased any Mexican flagged fish, so it really doesn't affect us one way or another. Generally, as a policy, we believe that embargoes are long-term detrimental to these situations. We feel that more properly, the market should be the ones that respond on these issues. Much as in the U.S., it was really the consumers' demands that forced the companies to adapt dolphin-safe policies in April of last year. Then the laws were subsequently made after that. So that's kind of our general policy, not certainly in every situation, but that's been our general policy.
In order to receive official status, the recent panel decision must be considered by the full council, headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland. Right now, it is not known what, if any, action will be taken by the U.S. Congress should the full council back the panel in its recommendations. We asked Patricia Norman, spokesperson for the Office of U.S. Trade Representatives, to characterize the administration's position at this time.
Well, as you know, on August 16th, the GATT dispute settlement panel issued its confidential report. We did receive a copy of the report, and we are studying it now, and for that reason, we're unable to comment on it.
Overall, though, Norman says,
my final statement is that we are committed to protecting the environment and preventing the unnecessary killing of dolphins.
The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was written in 1947. And though never formally ratified by the 102 participating nations, it has existed as the only such contract between the signing nations. Today, though, as Earth Island's David Phillips puts it, the agreement is way out of touch with the modern world.
And the U.S. understands this. This is why many countries are trying to renegotiate GATT right now to try to deal with issues such as agricultural subsidies and a number of the issues of the 80s and the 90s. For that reason, the U.S. government ought to make it quite clear that we are not interested in seeing GATT override environmental laws, and that GATT should be renegotiated in a way that secures international protection instead of running roughshod over them. I think that most countries right now are going to be hard-pressed to go along with GATT and participation in GATT if it is interpreted as something that completely erodes environmental protection laws and leaves the planet ravaged in the way of trade in endangered species, destruction of tropical rainforests. These are not the priorities of the countries in the 90s, and GATT has to get with it and come to sensibilities about the role of free trade versus the environment.
Even as the European community wrestles with the issues of how to forge a common bond while also preserving each nation's sovereign identity, so the issue is raised by Mexico. Just as Mexico would not have the right to rule, say, on how we should raise and slaughter beef cattle in the United States, we in the United States simply do not have the right to dictate to Mexico how it should catch tuna. Or do we? Again, David Phillips.
The point is that the U.S. is not saying to Mexico, you can't go out and kill dolphins. What the U.S. is saying, and I think what it is legitimate for a country to say, is if you do continue the use of that technology, then find another place to sell your product. Which would be no different than a radio station deciding that they didn't want to take a certain type of advertising. It's not saying that a company might not want to produce a product that had no social value or was inspired by the Ku Klux Klan or something, but it doesn't mean that you have to necessarily advertise it. We don't have to sell the products that are caught at full destruction of the world. We have no obligation to, and we should use what leverage we have to try to influence global environmental protection. These resources belong to the planet and are going to require extraordinary steps to try to make sure that they don't end up just being ravaged.
David Phillips, executive director of Earth Island Institute in San Francisco. In the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, schools of yellowfin tuna are usually found swimming beneath herds of dolphin. Thousands of dolphin are killed each year as they are hauled aboard fishing vessels with purse seine nets set out to catch the schools of tuna swimming beneath. Though most of the U.S. tuna fishing fleet has complied with the law banning the killing of dolphin, Phillips says there are still two vessels berthed in San Diego that continue to kill dolphin. The Pisces and the Cape St. Vincent, expected to kill up to 500 dolphin this year, sell their tuna to Italy and Spain. Phillips says this quota is accepted because U.S. law still allows, as we mentioned, up to 20,500 dolphin to be killed each year. The full council of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade is expected to review the panel recommendation and make a formal statement in October. This is Bruce Robertson. Towns and counties throughout the West are struggling with too much garbage. Landfills are outdated and below federal standards, causing concern in many communities. But as Nick Eisenberg tells us, a landfill in Pitkin County, Colorado, is looking at garbage in a new way, one that saves money and increases efficiency.
Gus Hallam's unloading a van full of trash at the Pitkin County, Colorado landfill. But he's doing much more than just dumping trash.
We're separating the trash, we're separating the lumber, we separate the plywood from the 2x4s, and we separate the brush and the limbs and the tree trimmings.
The system was created by Pitkin County Public Resource Manager Jim Duke to make it feasible to recycle what used to be buried.
We went from a flat rate for everything of $3 a yard. We quadrupled that to over $12 a yard for unsorted or unrecoverable wastes. If they're sorted to our specifications, they go down to $2 a yard, a six-fold savings for any commercial entities, and it's free for any private citizens.
Lumber will be sold as used lumber. If there are nails in it, they'll be pulled out by people ordered by the courts to perform useful public service. The limbs will be ground into wood chips and sold for landscaping. Additional scraps will be sold as firewood for $20 a cord. And anything left will go into a compost pile and eventually sold as topsoil. But that's not all that's compost. So is scrap drywall and newspaper. They're mixed with sludge from nearby sewage treatment plants. Jim Duke has two mulching operations, one with clean materials and a second with scraps which contain leaded paint.
As we get more and more painted lumbers, we're going to try to keep them totally separate, and we'll be putting out a reclamation grade compost. We still feel that these would be a good compost product to use in roadside revegetation where you already have pollutant contaminants from auto, you know, vehicles, which I assume are probably kind of concentrated on roadsides.
Huge dump trucks are bringing waste dirt and brush from construction projects into a crushing and screening operation run by dump contractor Frank Bishop. They're paying $2.50 a yard to drop it off. But Bishop says they're not going home empty.
They'll bring in a load of maybe gravel or concrete, and they'll turn around and take a load of topsoil out for another customer.
They even have a dump store, sort of the boutique of nearby Aspen and Snowmass's trash, where anything you could imagine can be picked up literally for free or close to it. Right now, the hottest moving item at the dump store is ski lift chairs. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Nick Eisenberg in Pitkin County, Colorado.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils of Billings, Montana.
What we're going to do tonight, actually, is talk a little bit about energy-efficient lighting. And energy-efficient lighting is the new revolution in energy conservation.
Alan Silverstein, co-director of the Western Massachusetts Center for Ecological Technology. And with words to this effect, workshops on energy efficiency are being opened all across the nation. While Congress and the President hum and buzz over controversial suggestions for an energy policy for the United States, private enterprise and private citizens are forging ahead, finding techniques and products that are helping to form not only an energy policy, but an energy lifestyle, and one that works.
It's a new technology. It's growing stronger every day. It's something that everyone feels can help in many different ways to reducing your electric bills to help saving the environment. And tonight, we're going to run through a couple of different ideas about energy-efficient lighting, get you more familiar with it, give you a little better point of reference, and compare it to the lighting that we're all used to, the regular old incandescent bulb that we've lived with for the last 100 years, and some of these products that we have on display tonight.
Silverstein opened the workshop before a small crowd gathered at Berkshire Community College in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. On display were 35 different types of energy-efficient fluorescent lights. CET staff member John Meyercheck presented some basic information first about incandescent lighting.
How this bulb works is very simple. Electricity goes through the filament, and as it travels through the filament heats up and glows, and that gives off light. It's actually a very efficient heater, but not a very efficient light bulb. Only about 5 to 10% of the energy that goes into this type of bulb is given off or changed into visible light. The remainder of that goes into heat.
Compared to an incandescent light, the typical fluorescent light has what is called a ballast.
The ballast has one or two main functions. It's there to control the amount of current that goes into the bulb. It also helps create enough voltage for the bulb to get started. And that's really all it does. It's very simple. It can either be a magnetic core coil ballast, which is just what it sounds like, a magnet, or it can be the solid state technology that you're looking at as we pass that around.
It is important to know the differences between the types of ballasts because you will choose the type of bulb based on the place where you intend to use it. The magnetic ballast has a slight delay in turning on the light, whereas the solid-state electronic device comes on immediately. This is important to know, especially if you are planning to mount the bulb in an area where you would want light to come on immediately, a stairwell, for instance. The other distinguishing feature of the modern energy-efficient fluorescent bulb is, of course, the bulb itself. It is not the massive overhead tube typically seen in public buildings, for example. The new tube is small and coiled, often in two or four loops, small, quite like the size of the more familiar incandescent bulb. The principle of lighting for fluorescent bulbs is basically this. A current of electricity enters the bulb to an electrode. An arc of current jumps to an electrode on the other end of the tube through a thin vapor of mercury gas. The gas glows because of the electric current. The gas becomes ionized, giving off ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light hits the phosphorus coating on the inside of the tube, then the coating fluoresces, giving off visible light. Voila! Some people are concerned about radioactive material in fluorescent bulbs with magnetic starters. John Meyercheck says the amount, while interesting, is not of concern.
Just to give you an idea, when the bulb is intact, there is no detectable radiation outside. and these tests have been done. If the bulb was completely crushed and you stayed inside a room the size of a closet with this bulb all day, what it gave off would be less than 1/1,000th of the natural background radiation that we get every day from the Earth.
As consumers shopping for these new bulbs, we need to know about something else. In addition, and perhaps more important than looking for the actual watt of the bulb, we need to know about lumens. A watt is a measurement of power, 40 watts, 60 watts. A lumen is a way of measuring how brightly a bulb will burn, actually how bright it will appear to our eyes in the setting in which we are planning to use it. The most efficient bulb is the one that burns with the least amount of electricity, but which gives the brightest light. Some compare the rating with the miles per gallon rating for cars. How big and fast is the car versus how well does it burn fuel? A fuel-efficient car does not have the same power as a car with a big engine. That, however, does burn a lot of gasoline. One unusual experiment conducted by Silverstein had a series of four fluorescent bulbs all wired to an electric meter, such as you would find attached outside your house. These bulbs were paired first to comparable incandescent bulbs on another lighting bar so we could compare the brightness, the lumens.
So on this end over here, we have a 9-watt quad with a side ballast lined up with a 40-watt incandescent. Here we have a 15-watt tube with a 60-watt. We have an 18-watt electronic tube with a 75-watt incandescent. And here we have a 22-watt quad tube with a 100-watt incandescent. And these lamps are giving out or drawing about 64 watts of energy. This one lamp in the back is drawing 60 watts of energy. And if you were up here in the front row like Bruce is, you would be able to see that these meters are spinning at roughly the same exact speed. So what we're doing is we're producing many, many more lumens for 1/4 the energy that's produced. And if we turn all these other incandescents on, we would glance down at this meter and we would watch it rapidly spinning away.
There are many drawbacks and problems yet to be worked out for compact, energy-efficient bulbs. Though they last up to 10 times as long as incandescent bulbs, fluorescent bulbs are also considerably more expensive. Also, because of the indigenous technology involved, these fluorescent bulbs are not useful everywhere we need and use lighting. First of all, the bulb must fit the type of lamp we are planning to use. Lamps with shades that clip right onto the bulb are not going to accept these new bulbs. Lamps that use a harp, the brass or alloy forked device that surrounds the bulb, rising above it onto which the shade is fastened, may have to be fitted with a larger harp or one adapted to fit the somewhat bulky fluorescent bulb. Finally, the new bulb cannot be used in fixtures run through a dimmer switch, in the den or dining room, for example. But as co-director of the center, Laura Dubester, explains, the benefits outweigh the drawbacks, even now, at this early stage.
I mean, it's really important to think about how do we get our electricity, and the fact is that our electricity mostly is generated from burning fossil fuels, and that could be gas or oil or uranium. All of these are non-renewable resources, which means once they're used up, they're gone. And we do need to protect and cherish our fossil fuels. The other aspect is that when we burn fuels, they give off pollutants to the atmosphere, and those pollutants contribute to acid rain, and they contribute to the greenhouse effect. And really, energy in the United States, or burning of energy in the United States and worldwide, is really the largest contributor to the greenhouse effect. And I think it's really inspiring that there is something that each of us can do in our own homes that can make a substantial impact to that, and that is to make that one change to using compact fluorescent bulbs. The rule of thumb, or one example, is that for every fluorescent bulb, you'll save the equivalent of, I think it's about 500 pounds of coal or a barrel of oil. And not only do you save that oil that's then, or coal that's in the ground, but you also save about 800 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions from burning that fuel.
Compact fluorescent bulbs are available from many catalog companies now. Some are even available at your local hardware store. Though costly at the outset, it is estimated that replacing, say, a 60-watt incandescent bulb with a comparable 15-watt compact fluorescent of similar lumens will save you $40 over the life of the bulb, just from that one bulb. And more bulbs mean more savings, and this is only 1991. And this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for Environment Show number 87. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.